Say Tema. Tema. The Geshe course and the studies in the monastery are divided into five great subjects. We spend the first 12 years on Wundo Gen Abhisamalankara, which is the perfection of wisdom. Then we do 4 years on Madhyamika Avatara of Chandrakirti, Umalajupa, which is middle way philosophy, emptiness. Then we spend 2 years on Zhe, which is Abhidhamma Kosha, Vaibhashika system. Then we spend 2 years on Dilawa Vinaya. And every winter, for about 3 to 4 months, we study Tsema. The Sanskrit for Tsema is Pramana. Pramana means valid perception, a normal perception, valid perception. Okay? You have them all day long. Okay? All day long you have pramanas. Okay? And, you know, they've been translated as valid cognizers and stuff like that. And, you know, very, very, it sounds like, gee, I don't know if I've ever had a valid cognizer. But all it means is a normal perception. Okay? And you have them all throughout the day over and over and over again. Every minute you have like a few hundred valid perceptions. Normal perceptions, okay? What's a not a tsema? What's a non-tsema? What's a non-pramana? What's an example of a non-pramana? Non-pramana, the one I like to say the most, when I would be driving in New Jersey down Fifth Street, and it's dusk, and it's in the autumn, and these leaves get blown across the road, and you see a blur off your peripheral vision, and then you slam on the brakes, because you think it's a squirrel, there's lots of squirrels there, and then you see it's just a leaf being, that moment of false perception is called temingilo. That's a non-pramana, you see? And those don't happen very often. Another example would be at work, you are jealous of someone, or you think someone's out after you, and then you come into work, and there's something bad has happened. And then you get this whole thing in your mind that this person has done something to you, that they planned it, that they executed it, and this problem is happening to you because this person. And then you find out they quit the company 3 days ago. They're not even there anymore. It's just a non-valid perception. You know, it's just your paranoia because you don't like this person. And those are two very common examples. You're jealous of somebody, so every move they make, everything they do seems to have meaning. You give it meaning, wrong meaning, you know what I mean? That's not a pramana either, okay? But 99.99% of your perceptions are pramanas, and you go around all day having pramanas, okay? Why is pramana important? Why do we study it for 3-4 months every year for 18 years? You see, I mean, what's so important about it? It's the science of learning how you know something. How do you know something is true? How do you decide whether something is true or not? And in every religion, you need to determine what is pramana. You know, how do you decide that something is true or false? What are the means at your disposal to decide whether something is true or false? And for that, you need pramana. You have to study what are the different ways of perceiving something. Okay, so really, pramana is the study of how do you see things? How do you perceive things? How do you confirm that something is true? Okay, and that's the study of pramana. And we do it, it's a big deal in Tibetan monastery. The first class that a young monk ever takes at age 13 in philosophy is how to debate, how to reason, how to think. And they do that, you do it for 2 years with your house teacher, and then you're allowed to go to the debate ground and start serious debating, logic. Okay? In debate, 3, 4, 5 hours a day, usually in the evening, every other day in the morning, for a couple more hours, you go to a special garden with a wall around it, and you sit on these beautiful flagstones. And at night, it's just so pleasant. In India, the stars are out. We didn't used to have electricity at night. And you walk into this walled courtyard, and there'd be about 300 people there. And it's like a high school dance. You walk around, you know, and you go like that, and the guy goes, you know, and you look around and try to catch somebody's eye that you'd like to debate with. And the first hour or hour and a half is open one-on-one debating, meaning you just walk around until, it's oftentimes you're just milling around and you bump into a guy, you know, you're standing there looking at each other and you might not even know him, and you say, okay, you want to go at it, you know, and he says, yeah. So one guy sits down, one guy stands up, and you just start. And usually they're not in the same class as you. There's about 15 classes in the monastery. You move up to, it's like freshman, sophomore, junior, but they have their own names. Like those who get to wear the wool tunics, you know, that's like year number 16 or something. And then you start. And one guy stands up, one guy sits down. You get a rosary. You have a rosary? That's a good one. And you say, you go like this, you know, and you think of something real fast. Okay, and the other guy's sitting down. I'll just show you a little bit. I don't want to disrupt you or anything, but ready, Pelma? This is how it really goes. You go up, and the first move is very respectful. You say, Di, Jidao Che Chen. And Di, there's two interpretations of Di. Di means either Di meaning wisdom or knowledge in Sanskrit, Di. And some people say Di means Di Di Tar Che Chen. What about this? In Tibetan, Di means this. You say Di Di Tar Che Chen. And then you say Ngana Ngandawa Mayemba. Means, I guess that quotation at the beginning of the Pramana book, the logic book, that says people like me, if you're not a person like me, you shouldn't try to judge other people. Yeah, it doesn't have any meaning at all. Nada. Nada. Shop. It's like, oh, you worthless thing, you know. You know, okay. And it's so fun. It's like the most fun thing. You know. And you do that for 5-6 hours. Your hands start to split. Blood is spraying in his face, you know. And it's really fun. And, you know, if you're a 20-year-old guy and you're celibate and, you know, you're like, you know, and they got these big muscles and, you know, they love it. And it's really good for a monk. You know, it's really, really good for energy. And everything is from memory. You cannot take a book into the debate ground. You'd be embarrassed forever, you know. Everything has to be in your mind. You have to memorize page after page after page. And then you start, and you make a very subtle wrong statement, you know, just a little bit wrong. And then they have to come back at you. And there's just this, you learn confidence. You know, like guys, 13-year-old, 15-year-old guys go in there, you know, and then their teacher grabs them and takes them back and shows them how to, you know, and then it's beautiful. And you can imagine 300 guys, you know, 150 screaming guys. And then the guy on this is like, duh, double drum, you know, and you're like, you idiot, you know, anyone can see that, you know, you now, yes, no, yes, maybe, no, yes, you know, and you got to be like that quick, you know, and he's throwing logic at you, you know, thing after thing, and then you go on for hours and hours, and it's like unbelievable. By the end of the night, you know what you're studying perfect, and you every morning you get about 2 or 3 hours of class, and then every night you're debating it. So then by the next day, you're loaded, you know, like you've already, you know it backwards and forwards, okay? And that's the whole goal of, that custom hasn't changed since the day of the Buddha, since the time. In the Buddha's time, it was very serious. If you lost a debate, you had to join the other guy's religion, okay? If the Baptists and the Catholics had a debate, and the king and his cabinet would watch, and then they'd say, we consider, this guy has stopped speaking, you know? This guy has nowhere to go. And everyone in the whole courtyard can see it. You know, you don't have to be a Buddhist or a philosopher. This guy can't say anything else. He's checkmated. You have to join the other religion. And they would take off their robes and they would join the other religion. You know, I think the stakes were very high in the old days. And it was who can prove something. You see, how can you prove it? It's also very good if you're going to be a teacher. You learn to take heat. You learn to be under pressure. You learn to you know, you learn to think ahead. You're usually thinking 4 or 5 moves ahead of the other guy. It's like a chess game, and there's a flow chart, and you're at each of those 5 permutations, and you're ready any way he goes, you know. When you do your Geshe debate and your pre-Geshe debate, you actually have to write out the flow chart of every possible answer for like an hour. And you go into the cornfield, you get a huge roll of rice paper, and you start writing tiny little flow charts. And then you pin it to your door and you memorize it for 3-4 months. You know, like, and that's one of your Geshe debates, you know. And it's really beautiful. You hire a calligrapher to do the final thing, and it's, you know, people keep them for the rest of their lives. It's like your college degree or something, you know. Anyway, pramana is for that. The classic use of pramana in the beginning, Buddha says, don't judge other people if you don't really know what they're thinking. If you can't read their minds, then don't judge them. And it refers to an ancient story of a bodhisattva who left the monastery during the day to go teach lay people in the city. And then one other monk was jealous of him and started rumors about his behavior. And then, other monks started to judge this person. And then finally, they threw him out of the monastery, or he had to leave the monastery. And Lord Buddha is reciting this tale because he was the person who was the nasty monk who judged the other monk. And because of that, he lost his rose in 500 lifetimes. He was born as a dog for 500 lifetimes. And then he's giving advice, you know, learn pramana, because if you learn pramana, you know what's true and you know what's not true, and especially you know that you can't judge other people because you can't read anyone's mind around you, so just forget it. Take care of your mental afflictions. Don't try to manage other people's mental afflictions. There's this whole art of managing other people's bad deeds and mental afflictions. You know, it's like, I think the book is a good example. You know, would you go to somebody and say, you know, I know your bad deeds better than you. Can I do your book for you today? You know what I mean? Can I keep track of your bad deeds for you today? I mean, you'd never do that. You'd never say that, but you do it all day long. You know what I mean? You're constantly judging other people, constantly believing that you know what they think or why they're acting, how they're acting, even what they're doing. And especially as you practice more and more, your whole perceptions change radically. If Buddhist practice works, then, for example, my perception of my reality is much different than it was 25 years ago. If Buddhist practice doesn't work, then I'm seeing the world the same way I did 25 years ago. You see what I mean? Even if I've given it a little effort, I'm seeing the world in a radically different way after 25 years of Buddhist practice. So how do you know how people are thinking or perceiving things or seeing things? You can't. And the study of pramana is for that. I want to talk a little bit about the logic side of pramana, and then we'll talk a little bit about one of the most famous applications of pramana in perceiving emptiness. Okay, so we're talking about what makes a pramana. What are the kinds of pramana? Basically, two types of pramana. Okay, very simply, and we study it hundreds and hundreds of pages, but I'm just shortening it like that. Okay, one, the things you see with your eyes and ears and nose and tongue, direct perceptions, thoughts you have directly in your mind when you hear Son of Thor talking in your mind. You know what I mean? When you hear your mind talking. Those are direct perceptions. Okay? And those are correct. Except for when the leaf is crossing the road or something like that. Secondly, we have what we call deductive perceptions. Meaning, you know, can you see this pen?
Yeah.
Did you hear anything drop behind me? No. I hope not. What do I have behind my back? A pen, okay? Is that a pramana? Is your perception of that pen a pramana? We say yes, deductive perception. Okay? So in Buddhism, what you have to appreciate in Buddhism is that seeing it with your eyes and seeing it with your mind are equally valid. Equally valid. Okay? And it's as good as seeing it with your eyes. And there are many spiritual truths. There are many kinds of reality that you cannot see right now. You can only figure them out. Okay? You can figure out that they're there. Later you can see them directly. But hey, don't deny yourself the benefits of understanding that it's there before you see it directly. It's like certain kinds of physics or astronomy where you can't see the object itself, but you see its traces, so you know it's there. It's the same thing. It's the study of perceiving objects with reasoning, okay? And you have to realize that in Buddhism, that counts as good as your eyes. Okay, if you see emptiness with your reasoning, it's as good as your eyes. What's the point of all this? You see, it'll be a long time before you can see, if you are who you seem to be, and I don't know, it'll be a long time before you can see emptiness or before you can especially see how karma works directly. Okay, but if you figure out that karma makes sense, then you can do this thing of the most difficult thing for a Buddhist to do. Knowing that karma is true. Like your boss says, will you go out and lie to this supplier so that I can save $1,000 on the next bill? Tell him this diamond is only worth so-and-so. And if it works, okay, we made $1,000. I might even give you $1 at your Christmas bonus. You know, but the company will make more money. And if it doesn't work, we'll just pay him what it's worth. It's okay. So he tells you to lie. You go out, you lie, and it works. And he sells the thing to you for $1,000 under value. Okay? Did it work? See, that's the big thing in Buddhism. Did it really work? You know, according to Buddhism, it's impossible for a lie to produce $1,000. According to Buddhism, the $1,000 is created because you were generous in the past. And the lie is going to result in something like nobody believing you in the future. And the fact that the lie came just before the $1,000, there's no connection at all. It's a total illusion. You see what I mean? You can understand that intellectually. At a certain point in your Buddhist practice, you can live on that basis. You see what I mean? You can refuse to do negative actions because you know they can't help. Even if they seem to help, they don't help. You see what I mean? By the way, I'm not trying to prove that tonight, but what's the proof anyway that lies don't produce profits? They don't always work. You see? They don't always work. Are you telling me that generosity always works? Yeah. Yeah, every time you're generous to someone, you get hundreds of times more back. Period. And it's the only thing that works. And if you happen to get more money right after you told a lie, it's just happening next to each other and there's no cause and effect there. Okay? Now, once you've figured it out through hundreds of hours of Buddhist classes that this is probably correct, you know, once you're satisfied that it's correct, you've had a deductive pramana, a deductive perception of the truth of this thing, and then you start living by it, even before you can directly see the future or your future lives. If you start living by it now, that's the use of pramana. That's the use of deduction. You see what I mean? You start living a totally pure life now, because you're convinced by deduction that it works, but you can't perceive it. You know, I can't see that if I give this pen away to Pell. I gave it to her last class. I still didn't have any pens this week. You know, I don't believe it, you know, or something like that. By deduction, I believe it, you see. And the reason to study deduction in Buddhism, the reason to study logic is for that, okay? It's to get you acting on that basis and getting yourself into a tantric paradise because of you've reasoned it out that this is correct. Before you can see directly that money leads to money and bad deeds lead to bad results, you know? But you just, on deduction, you figured it out that it's probably true and you act on that. You see what I mean? That's the great benefit. And we're going to talk about perceiving emptiness through deduction. You have to see it first by reasoning. And then later you have this immense 20 minutes that stops your suffering forever. You know, you become an enlightened being because of that 20 minutes. You see what I mean? That first you have to see it with reasoning, deduction, and then later you can see it directly. But you have to go through this process. So you need pramana. Yeah. Oh, those are kinds of pramana. Yeah, those are kind of deduction. There's three kinds of deduction, and this is a whole lifetime of study. You can spend a lifetime on it, okay? And it's beautiful. And I only put one course in the syllabus for logic because I was afraid most people wouldn't like it. But I think in Arizona, after 3 years, we'll get really serious about it. We'll have an English debating and go over the real course in logic would take you 5 or 6 years to finish. You know what I mean? And it's beautiful, and it's intense, and it's it's just incredible, okay? I'm going to give you a taste of it, okay, ready? It's something that I was not attracted to, and I did not like, and I thought was worthless. And, you know, Ken Rinpoche kindly convinced me to study it, and now it's like the most precious thing. Gyaltsebje, I believe it was, said that the kindest thing that Jetson Kapa ever did for him was to teach him logic. Say, Taksu Kapa. It's like a mantra in the debate ground. Taksu Kapa Takitini. Yimbatao, duh. Okay? Taksu Kapa means anything which is put forth as a reason, anything which is posited by the opponent as a reason, is a reason. Okay? The sky is blue because potatoes are 20 feet high. Okay? What's the dak? What's the reason? Potatoes are 20 feet high. Is it a reason? Yes. Why? It's false. Doesn't matter. Taksukupa takatini. Anything that you put forward as a reason is the reason. Okay? I didn't say good reason, did I? Okay? Which means, doesn't matter if a thing exists or not. Everything is a reason. Everything you can choose is a reason. Okay? Choose anything. Because rabbit's horns are 13 inches long, except in the winter. Okay? Is a reason. Everything is a reason. Anything existing or non-existing can be used as a reason. Because somebody can say, my reason for saying is that rabbits have horns that are 13 inches long in winter. Okay? And that's enough to be a reason. That's all you need to be a reason. Okay? I didn't say good reason. Okay? Maybe we should go on to good reason. Okay. Take that out. Say tsusum, yimba, dayanda. Tsusum, yimba, dayanda. Okay. Tsusum means the three relationships, the three necessary relationships. Okay. Tsu means relationship here. Sum means three. Yimba means that reason with which the three relationships hold, or in which they are true, okay? That reason in which the three relationships hold is the definition of a Dagyang Dak. Dagyang Dak means correct reason, okay? Correct reason. So a correct reason always enjoys three relationships with other parts of your statement, and we're going to go through them now. Because I would be embarrassed if somebody said, oh, this is a Geshe that graduated from ACI, but they don't know Tsulsum. Okay? Rinpoche had a sweet student from Washington, D.C. named Susan Meinheit, and he christened her Tsulsum because he heard it Susan as Tsulsum. So we call McKenna Tsulsum. That's why McKenna, okay? Where are you? Okay. So don't worry about it. That's just a joke. Okay. Okay, I'm going to give you the three relationships. It takes in the monastery maybe 2 months to thrash out these three, but we'll do it. 신된 주신 김에게 되는 것은 난 듣고 여분이를 설명해봐 조숙이 세니 I haven't done it for like 6-7 years, but it's like a mantra, okay? 촉추 means the relationship between the reason and the subject holds, okay? So I'll tell you what the reason and the subject is. The classical argument for all logic is jachi chemi tata chepi chair means take sound, it's a changing thing. The because it's made. You can say it's a made thing. When they teach logic to baby monks, it's always you know, and they go around, you know, they're really good at all the hand stuff, and then they don't remember what to say sometimes. But it's really cute to see like 2 7-year-old monks, you know, going at it. Anyway, this is a response to non-Buddhist schools of ancient India that said that Om was eternal, and that Om didn't change. You see, I mean, that the sound Om lasted forever and didn't change, okay? Which, according to Buddhism, is silly because you have to breathe to say it, so it changes. You see what I mean? Anything that has a cause changes. Which is a long story. I'm not going to get into it now. But Chokcho means that the subject, which in this case is sound, and the reason, which in this case is a made thing, do have a relationship. Sound is a made thing. Okay? This is so far, this is a good logical statement to give to someone as a proof for something, because the subject and the reason have a relationship. The reason applies to the subject. Okay, it's true that sound is a made thing. That's Chokcho. Okay, so you can define Chokcho as the relationship between the subject and the reason. Okay, it holds. The first proof, the first test of a good proof holds, which is that sound is a made thing, okay? So the first one is okay. We're 1/3 of the way of proving this logical statement. Okay, number two. The first sul holds. Let me sit down here. Say Jacob.
Jacob.
Jacob. Jacob literally means reverse necessity. Okay? Reverse necessity. Wow. Okay. And by the way, logic is a whole separate language in Tibetan. There's probably 500 unique words in the study of logic, and you know, they're very, very, you need a good teacher and you need to study it for a long time. What does reverse necessity mean? It's very simple. If something is a made thing, it must be a changing thing. You see, you're just going backwards in the proof. So now I'm going to use this mark, okay? If something is a made thing, it must be a changing thing. Is that true? If something has been created by causes, must it be changing all the time? Yeah, because the cause has a certain energy that it imparts to the result, and the result varies as the cause has put energy into it. You see, you hit the white ball with the pull cue, and it hits the eight ball, and then the energy is transferred to that. And because the energy of the white ball is not infinite, what happens to the black ball? Hopefully it stops short of the pocket. You see what I mean? The energy wears out. Everything's like that. Everything's like that. All cause things are like that. The cause imparts a certain energy to the result, and because the cause's energy is finite, sooner or later the result slows down. And it slows down incrementally all the time. So it's always changing. Anything which has ever been produced is necessarily changing all the time because its energy is getting lost. You know that if you're over 40. Okay? Like, you're losing your energy because the cause is wearing out. What's the cause? Your karma. Your perception of health and vitality is wearing out. Okay? So anything that was ever made is always changing. That's a Jacob. So relationship number two holds. Sulsum number two holds. Okay? Necessity means must be. Okay? If it's number three, it must be number two. Sorry? Dukjachu. The thing to be proven. The quality to be proven. Okay? The changing thing part. Okay? Let me just make sure I spelled this right. Yeah. Say dokyap. Dokyap. Dokyap means if something's not number two, it can't be number three. And it's just another test of veracity. It's another truth test. If something cannot be number two, if something is not number two, It cannot be number three. Which is just to say, if something's not a changing thing, it cannot be a made thing. Okay? If it weren't changing, it couldn't be made. If you really think about Jacob and Dokyap, if Jacob holds for something, Dokyap has to hold. And there's some exotic exceptions, but anyway, it's just another, like a confirmation step. It's a verification step, okay? If these three relationships hold, Chokchu being one is three. Jacob being if something is two, I'm sorry, if something is three, must be what? Two. And then Dokyap, if something is not two, cannot be three. Okay? If you've tested a statement, and if those three relationships hold true, then the statement must be true. Okay? And that's the test of a correct reason. So we've gone from reason, which was what? Defined as what? Anything you want to say is a reason. You know, I don't like you because, you know, ice cream is too sweet. You know, it's a reason. Does it have the three tools? Is ice cream sweet? Yes. Is something being sweet a reason not to like somebody? No. If you like somebody, are they always not sweet? No. Oh, so it's a bad reason. Right. Okay, that's all. And these are the three tests of a good reason. Now I'll tell you the neat punchline. And then we'll go to an actual thing. A good opponent, a worthy opponent, a proper opponent in a debate must already accept that it has all three. Okay? Not allowed to give an argument to somebody unless they already accept all three. Okay? You mean I can't give this argument, sound is a changing thing because it's a made thing, to anybody unless they've already seen that the three parts are true? Right. What do they have to see? Sound is a made thing. If something is made, it has to be changing. If it's not changing, it can't be made. And if he doesn't say, I agree, I agree, I agree to all three, you have given him a bad reason. It's very beautiful. In Buddhist logic, if your opponent doesn't already accept the truth of all three parts, you've given him a false reason. You see, the test of falsity is not universally true or false. The test of falsity is, have you chosen the right reason to give to this opponent? Okay? It's very beautiful. Why do we have to talk about this? What's the point? Do you want me to put you to sleep with the other details of logic? You know, we can go on. And by the way, the book is that thick. I just finished like 80 more pages of the reading, you know, because I wanted to give you all the basics of logic in one notebook, okay? But the point is, in America, you are going to be teachers. This is whether it's at your job, whether it's with people you talk with, whether it's your family, whether it's a small group of people in the future, whether it's 500 people in a hall somewhere in the future, you guys are going to be the teachers in America. You are the lineage holders. It's your job. People ask me, is it okay to teach? I'm like, no, it's not okay not to teach. Okay? Because I'm, you know, that's the way it works. You pass on the lineage. Okay? The interesting thing is that more than other people in history, you will be called upon to prove what you believe. You know? People will challenge you. All the way from the beginning of the Lamrim up to highest tantric practices. People will question you. And they do. You know, Americans are well-educated. Americans are skeptical. Americans have mostly rejected whatever religions they grew up with. And they are not going to believe it unless you can prove it. And you have to follow this. You have to know the rules of proving something, and you have to honor them, or you're not a good Buddhist teacher. You see what I mean? What it means on the bottom line is, you can only give someone an argument that they already accept, but they haven't figured it out. Okay, that's the bottom line. That's what I'm trying to say. You see? You say, do you think that? They say, yeah. Do you think that? Yeah, I believe that. So necessarily you believe that. Oh, God, I never thought of that. I guess I do. You see, I mean, very good with, like, Creator God, you know. You don't go up to somebody and say, do you believe God made the world? They say, yeah, you know. You say, well, they didn't, you know. And, you know, you don't, that's not a Buddhist debate, okay. You say something like, if you could make anything you wanted, would you make it nice? If you could make a person, you know, would you make him nice? Or would you make him with AIDS, you know? You say, oh, come on, I'm not crazy, I'd make him nice, you know. And then you'd say, well, you know, do normal people have AIDS? You say, yeah. So they weren't made by a nice person, right? I never thought of that. You see, I mean, and they say, okay, so you can agree with me. This is not what's making people have AIDS. It's not like there's some sadistic guy with this long white beard who says, oh, that half the people should have AIDS. Two-month-old kids should inherit AIDS from their parents, you know. But they just never thought of it that way. You see, I mean, so the trick is to provide the same information that they already know in a different package, so when you lower the boom, they have to go, oh, yeah, I guess that's right. You see, I mean, but you set it up, okay, as a logical statement. You get them to agree to the three parts, and then you sit back and let them have their conclusion, you know. And you don't sit there and argue, and if you're arguing, you've gone too many steps ahead. If you're in an argument with another person to try to convince them of something, if it gets to an argument, you've broken the rules of Buddhist logic already, okay? What I'm trying to say is, you just cruise along on what they believe, point after point after point, and you lead them to the conclusion, and then you just step back, you know? And then if they say, no, you know, then you say, "Nyun ding wan da zhe fa mei mei he." Well, I'm not going to debate with crazy people. No, I mean, you take them up to the point where, say, do you believe this? Yeah. Do you believe that? Yeah. Well, don't you think that? You know, and at that point they say, oh, I still don't believe that. You know, and they say, okay, I'll see you later. Okay? Like that. Why are you trying to convince them, okay? It's not that Buddhist church is going to get more contributions than other people, because once you convince them of a Buddhist lifestyle, they don't have any money anyway. Okay? Okay? It's not like that. It's that if you can get them to understand emptiness and karma, they can reach a tantric paradise in this lifetime. And that's all. You're just trying to give them something that will save their lives. In a very non-missionary, I'm talking someone who's willing to engage with you on a happy, you know, not talking going to work and trying to, you know, fight with people like that. A Buddhist presentation is moving along at a very acceptable idea, and then boom, you know what? Then you must have to accept that. Oh boy. I guess so. You see what I mean? And then you take them through a bunch of times like that. I had a Baptist, a lifelong Baptist, a lifelong Catholic, came up to my retreat cabin in Flagstaff one time, childhood friends. And after 3 days of, we hadn't seen each other since third grade or something. I mean, we met in third grade, we hadn't seen each other since 12th grade. And then after 3 days, they were both like, yeah, I can accept everything you say. No problem. I believe in past and future lives. I believe in karma. I believe in emptiness. I'll keep that Buddhist vows, and I'll stay a Catholic and a Baptist. You know, that's cool. Like that. Sarge, I got one more thing, okay? All right. The application is in your life. You will be called upon from hour to hour to help people. Help them at a certain rate of speed at which you never use anything that they haven't already accepted. To help show them, all you're doing is just showing them what they already would have accepted if they thought about it. You see what I mean? That's the art of Buddhist logic, okay? One more thing. Say, chi, chada, chi, chada. There's a thing called dura. Dura is, somebody went through the ancient books on logic and pramana, and they collected together all the neat little arguments, and they made a book called Dura. Dura is baby logic. Every young monk does it for 3-4 years. You do it with your house teacher is like your den mother. Your parents come, they drop you off at the monastery, you get a house teacher. You know, they teach you how to eat, they teach you how to put your robes on, they teach you stuff like that. And then they teach you Dura, you know, which is like collected topics of logic. And they start you on the baby stuff. You know, this is blue, this is yellow, or something's blue. All blue, it can't be yellow. Blue and yellow are contradictory. That's what contradiction means. And then you teach them from that. At age like 13, they start. And then, you know, later they get to do formal logic. And after that, they get to do perceptual theory. And then they're about 16, 17, they start doing that. So it's common in the monastery and monastic circles to say, what are you working on nowadays? You know, and somebody say Dura, and they'll say, oh boy, back at 13-year-old stuff. You know what I mean? I had a lama, a Mongolian lama, Geshe Galden. He was 80-something. He had tuberculosis. One lung was cut out. He was dying in Howell, in the back where Ngawang lives now. And he's on his deathbed. And he's propped up on the pillows, and he's reading Dura. He's reading elementary logic and perceptual theory. And I'm like, Geshe Lao, you sure you don't want to do, you know, some tantric ritual or anything? And he's like, are you kidding? Dura is the most important thing in the world, you know? And I'm like, why? You know, and he says, oh man, Dura, you can see emptiness if you know Dura. You know, I want to set up my next life. You know, he says, I'm setting up my next life, you know? And he gave me that book. I have it. It's at Michael Wick's house, actually. He gave me his logic book, and he died with, like that, you know, studying Dura. This is really the key for seeing emptiness, Chi Che Da. This is one of the Dura topics, okay? Chi means, we're going to call it quality. And Che Da means characteristic. And if you really want to see emptiness directly, 20 minutes in which you see your enlightenment, you see your future lives, you never need another thing in your whole life. Nothing. Your life is finished. Your enlightenment is certain. You know it. You see it. Nobody in the world can really give you a problem. You see what I mean? Anything can happen. Anyone can think anything of you. But you know what you saw, and you saw it, and you're on your way, and you know it. You can do it if you understand Chi Che Da. Okay? You have to understand Chi Che Da first. So quality, you can say karness. The quality called kar. Kar with quotation marks. And very importantly, and you have to write this sentence, okay? Thing which is characteristic of karness. Say karness. Oh, sorry. Okay. Which equals a car. For example, a Chevy. My father hated Fords for some reason, and everything had to be a Chevy. It was a big thing when I was a kid, you know. I don't know why. Okay. So there's this quality called karness, or kar. And there are the things in the world which are typical of that, or characteristic of that. And that's what I mean when I say characteristic. And don't forget it. It's one of the most important things I can ever teach you. There's a thing about this subject. You, like so many things in Buddhism, you cannot understand what I'm about to say unless you have kelwa. Say kelwa. Kelwa. Kelwa means virtue power in your heart. From helping other people, from serving your lama, from thinking kind thoughts, from doing good day after day, year after year, you collect this thing called kelwa. If you have kelwa, you get it. If you don't have kelwa, you don't get it. And there's no other way to get it. Okay? And it goes all the way up to Tantra. You can stand there and tell somebody, Look, this is a deity. I'm telling you, this is a deity. And they look, you know, and they say, it looks like a normal schmuck to me. You know, They don't have kawa. You see, even if they thought it was polite to agree with you, they don't see it. They don't have kawa. You see what I mean? And it causes a lot of problems in the world. You know, you go around saying things to people without kawa, and they're like, oh, you're crazy, or you're dirty, or you're mad, or you're something, because they don't have kawa. You see what I mean? You got to have kawa to see this. You have to have kawa to see emptiness. Rinpoche, before he went into Madhyamika class, and traditionally in Ceremay, they went off for 6 months or a year of meditation to recite mantras or to do something to get good karma, help the poor, raise money for the poor, stuff like that. And then they were allowed to enter Madhyamika class, because you got to have kawa, okay? So here it goes. If it seems irrelevant, then go get some more kawa. If you really understood it, you'd see emptiness directly. It goes like this. You understand subtle impermanence directly. You understand chi che da directly. Then you see dependent origination, and then that same day you see emptiness directly. Period. Okay? You can't do it without kawa. You gotta have kawa. Okay? So, there's a thing called chi, which is karnness. Or, I'll just say it. Ready? Car. Okay? Remember people go like that? It's quote, car. The idea car. The concept car. The thing you see in your mind when you close your eyes, car. When you hear the word car. Car-ness. Okay? Cardi. Okay? It's what allows you to recognize the thing is a car. You go out on the street, you look at this shape and this circle, and you say, oh, it's a car. And the prominent schools were obsessed with this. How do people know it's an ox when they look at those four sticks and this barrel? What is it? You know, what makes people understand that? How come they see that? It's oxness. Get it? You know, you make something in your mind called oxness. There's something in your mind that says oxness. You know, there's an idea of oxness. There's a quality called oxness. And then when you see this thing, you say, oh, that's an ox. Okay? And that's chedat. A-car. A-car and car are different, right? A-car and car are different. Okay? A-car is characteristic of the quality car-ness. A-car is characteristic of car. Okay? So you gotta sit there and practice that. Okay? You gotta think about it. It's not something I can explain any further. Especially with him waving his arms. Okay? Which means, no, from then on it's kawa. You got to meditate on it, you got to think it. Within this single page is contained the key to see emptiness directly and be out of here. You just have to cook it. Okay? You have to meditate on it. And you have to collect some good karma. Go do some kawa. Help somebody, do anything. Okay? Heavy duty karma. And then sit there and worry about this thing. My God, he said this was important somehow. I don't get it. You know? It's absolutely, you will see emptiness a few days after you really get this page. Okay? You have to think about it. Okay? Yeah, you have a question?
No, it's just you're speaking of the archetype of the car. Right?
You can say archetype or whatever. Oh, I think everyone will have a different idea about it. But herein lies the key. It is the most precious teaching on logic. You have to figure it out. Okay, I can't do anything else than that. Yeah? You guys got to debate that. Okay? All right, take a break. And we'll do some more logic next time. Okay,
first, I'm really bad at public speaking, so I have a lot of pictures to distract you. So pay attention to those. And while I'm talking... think about kawa, what he was talking about. This is the greatest opportunity to accumulate kawa here. You're going to see that all the pictures are of people, and it's because in Mongolia the most amazing thing is the people. They're really beautiful and they're really warm and they have wonderful smiles and wonderful hearts, and I was totally blown away. I was really surprised, and I really loved it there. And I hope you'll get a sense of that. Just slowly. There's not so many. The first thing I want to talk about is just really briefly just mention that I guess you all know a little bit about Mongolia. Geshe La talks about it all the time. It's a great country with a great history, a really rich culture. It had one of the biggest empires in human history at one point. Now it's a very poor country. Since the end of the Soviet Union, they have become sort of disastrously poor, and their lives have changed really dramatically. They can have access to Buddhism again, but they don't have a lot of access to money right now. So they're in a really bad place. There's some problems they're having with China, and like all the former Soviet states, they're in a really bad way. The transition to capitalism has been really hard for them. They've been a Buddhist country for several centuries now, but there was an interruption in their transmission of their teachings, and now there are monks again, and there's monasteries opening. There are actually quite a few monasteries happening rapidly. But there's very few great Buddhist teachers there yet, and some of the monks are maybe not so well trained yet. One problem that they're facing right now is that a lot of Christians are coming. There's full-time Christian broadcasting on television. They have basically two television stations. One of them is their sort of shoddy Mongolian television, and the other is this really glossy, expensive 24-hour Christian programming. There's also a lot of rumors in Mongolia sort of reflecting their anxiety about all the Christians coming. So they're really concerned that they can maybe try to keep something of their Buddhist past in the face of capitalism and Christianity and all these things that are coming from the West. So we received, in the span of maybe a week after Geshe La's talks there, I think 300 or 400 letters from people of all ages. Really, some of them really moving letters. In general, they say things like, I have many Christian friends. They tell me that Buddhism is bad. I'm afraid to tell them that I'm a Buddhist or that I believe in the Buddha because I don't really understand my own religion. And can you please help us understand more about Buddhism so that we can at least be proud of who we are and where we're coming from? So based on this really enthusiastic invitation from a lot of people, we are now setting up a school in Ulaanbaatar. We've got a space, a very good space. There's actually a lot of people going to Ulaanbaatar right now. FPMT, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's people, have just bought a gigantic building in the town square. A really beautiful building, and I just got confirmation today that I think that they have bought it. So that's really, really good. It's right next to the gigantic, brand new Mormon temple. our space is going to be immediately adjacent to that, so it'll be really convenient for all of us. We can bring the Mormons over. We have, I think Geshe La has talked a lot about the TV show. A lot of people here have worked on these TV shows. They're airing now. They've already shown, I think, two of them. They're maybe showing the third one tonight. I think it's Friday in Mongolia. So maybe tonight they're showing the third one. Those are, even before I left, people were talking about those. There's an amazing amount of enthusiasm about these things. Everywhere I went, people were stopping me in the street, saying, when are the classes? Where are the classes going to be? How can we get involved in the classes? And everyone knows Geshe La. He's like the biggest rock star to happen. he's really famous. So there's amazing enthusiasm. At this point, we have many more students who want to take classes than we can possibly accommodate. We have four teachers. they all have full-time jobs, and they don't—they can't work full-time. So we're in great need of some volunteers if people would like to get some kelwa. Right now we have—we're going to try to offer five classes at a time. Classes will last; they'll be modeled after these classes. They'll be focusing on English at first, and then there'll be one all-Dharma class on Fridays. Classes will last about 5 weeks. They'll be maybe 20 hours. They'll be very basic. We'll have one advanced class for people who know some more English. I guess the one thing that I really want to communicate is that this is a people who are amazingly kind-hearted, beautiful, wonderful people, and they're really in a moment of great need, and it's a rare moment in their history. I mean, they've had desperate moments in the past, but this is a very critical opportunity in the history of Mongolia, and in part because our own teachings come to us because of some moments in Mongolian history and our connection with Mongolia. I think this is just a really great opportunity for all of you. If anyone is remotely interested in coming to Mongolia, even for a month or 2 months or more, we have some great opportunities. We have a school established. We can get housing for people. And we can get you more students than you would know what to do with. And these are people who are trying to teach themselves English with the most crappy newspapers and magazines that they can get their hands on. And they're really, really desperate to learn English. The idea is that I think they feel that their culture is in danger of vanishing, and probably rightly so, that their country may be even in danger of vanishing. And the idea is that if they can get more ties with the West, more understanding of sort of global cultures, they can change the course of Mongolian history and become a country that's alive again and really growing, and they can reclaim their own Buddhist heritage, which they're really proud of, but sort of embarrassingly poorly educated on right now. So I would like to invite anybody who's even remotely interested, even if they're not able to, if you're not able to come or anything like that, we have many needs. Things like helping to write curriculums, collecting books to send to Mongolia. There's a great need for English books of all kinds. Any ideas you have, please contact me. And maybe tonight after class, if anybody is interested, some of us could go have some coffee together. Mary Oberdorf was just in Mongolia and had a fantastic time, and she can help gush about Mongolia better than... Yeah, we have a whole bunch of pictures. This is just some of them. Can you show some more pictures?
Sure.
So you can come see those afterwards as well. And feel free to call me at any time. Yeah.
I think I went through all of them.
Can I get a piece of plastic?
You want to write it on the bottom of my
name? Okay. Many of these didn't come out so well. Many of these scenes that look like riot scenes are the extremely enthusiastic crowd when Geshe-la was talking. He talked very appropriately at the National Circus. And it was crazy. It was really crazy. Even in New York, I've never seen anything quite like it. Okay.
2 years. And I think it's one of the four pillars of Tibetan Buddhism, was it? Meditation, retreat, study. I'm sorry, meditation and retreat, daily practice, study, and then serve somebody, help somebody. You see what I mean? And I want to thank Thomas especially. He didn't know what he was getting into. He broke his leg just before he got on the plane. He came anyway on crutches. We met him in Seoul Airport or some on crutches. He crutched around Mongolia, got started, got the school started, you know, got stuck there without any money because he stayed an extra week. He overstayed his ticket. And you know, and pulled off amazing things there while he was there. So I just want to thank him again. It's the last free Tibetan Buddhist country in the world. It's the last really Mahayana Buddhist country left in the world. So I think it's very important to help save it. They have 1.5 million books that were burned in Tibet. Are sitting there in Mongolia. So if we don't help them now, it'll be too late. So really think about it, okay? All right, good night. Talk to Thomas. All right, we'll do a prayer. Next week, next class is next week?
Oh, yeah. You must be, huh?
Teacher.